it's extremely satisfying and gratifying to be here for a whole variety of reasons. But one is to see the fruits of labor that's been going on now in Bozeman for, Rick, since about 1970 when we started working together. I come from Bozeman, Montana. I live there by choice. One of the interesting things about Bozeman is that we start nearly every public meeting with a prayer for global warming. We're very sensible people. We have an 80, at our ranch is almost precisely a mile high. We have on a good year, we'll have an 82-day growing season. We can't grow tomatoes or sweet corn. Some years we don't even get a second cutting of alfalfa. So you can understand why we are rather less skeptical. In fact, we're plumb hopeful about global warming. It's really quite remarkable that here we were in this tiny little school, this little cow college, and when Rick and I went there, it had less than 10,000 people. And it appears, and I don't mean to be terribly self-congratulatory about this, but it appears as though we've, in some fundamental way, changed the way the world thinks about natural resource and environmental issues. I see Joe Kwong sitting here. Joe spent some time in Bozeman and added greatly to our portfolio. It's just really fun to see the fact that we have indeed had an impact. The history is rather short. I was director of the first institute, which is at Montana State, the Center for Political Economy and Natural Resources. Rather long name. You'll still occasionally see notebooks from our early session. Terry, is that one you're carrying now? Is that one of the originals? That's a new one. All right. At any rate, this has been going on a long time. Through the good offices of someone who many of you will know and who I hold in great respect, Neil McLeod, who'd been president of the Liberty Fund for some years, he discovered this remnant band of wild scholars in Bozeman. He helped us create that center, and then through his good offices and the funds of Dick Larry and a variety of other people, they encouraged me to create something called PERC, Political Economy Research Center, and that had lots of nice things that it did include. It fostered romance, and so Jane Shaw got together with Rick Stroop, and we've done several of these, and it's really fun to do this. Well, let me make a few fundamental distinctions. First is that all of environmental studies is divided into two types. First, there is romance, and the second is sludge. Now, romance deals with things like wilderness areas and parks and big animals with brown eyes or little slanty yellow eyes, range and forest and things like that, and that's what I specialize in, is the romance side. Probably the more important side is the sludge. Dioxin, industrial wastes, and that sort of thing. I don't deal with that. Oh, I occasionally write a little bit about it, but very, very little. I prefer to deal with the romance side. And so the environmentalists with whom I deal, and I do deal with them on a very regular basis, they're people who care basically about real things, real places. Cutthroat trout, wolves, grizzly bears, wilderness areas, health of the forests, and so forth. And so my perception is going to be rather different than those of you, people like Fred Smith, who deal basically in and within the Beltway. Those people are sludge people in many ways. Now, the Washington Post on April 9th, on the front page, ran this piece called "Issue Groups Fund Seminars from Judges, Conservative Foundation Fund Resort Seminars for Federal Judges." Front page article in the Washington Post. Well, it was really quite a hit job. Let me just read my response. "Were a Pulitzer Prize given for the article that selectively employed isolated facts to generate fundamentally erroneous misunderstandings of a situation, Ruth Marcus would be a strong contender for our April 9th article," and so forth. Well, they wouldn't run my response. They would only run a response that was okayed, that was signed off on by the author of the original article, which I thought was really quite remarkable. But I haven't done time, much time, within the Beltway. People from Washington are not surprised by this. At any rate, the article was reprinted around the country. Often they would call judges who had attended and ask them their take on it, and they said, you know, luxury, my God, they made us sit in class 5 hours a day, they assigned 350 pages of reading, and we had to sign a contract that we would actually do it. The only heat was wood stoves, and it was 28 degrees, and this is not luxury. At any rate, it was fairly good, the response of the judges. The thing that I found most gratifying, however, was the fact that quite a few environmental leaders, people with really strong green credentials, came to our defense. I thought that was really quite remarkable. And I was pleased and I was gratified. Let me talk about that for a few minutes, because my mother wanted me to become a missionary. I think I did, but not the sort that she wanted. She wanted me to be a Missouri-centered Lutheran missionary, and instead I'm more of a libertarian missionary. But at any rate, my colleagues and I have suffered from such attacks as this for 25 years. This is the first time that I know of that any of the environmental leaders came to our defense. Why did they do this? Well, for one thing, because we've made systematic efforts to involve them in the programs. One of the things that I knew, and several judges, Danny and Doug Ginsburg, both of whom are on our board, one of the things that they told me was that judges are used to hearing both sides, or at least two sides. And that it was very important that we have real, genuine environmentalists make presentations. And so we do. We did. So they knew the program, and they were offended by the dishonesty and the misrepresentation of the Washington Post's author, who, by the way, I sent her the text that we used for the judges, and I sent her the schedule from one of the science and risk programs, that I think one that Bruce Ames spoke at, and each of the chapters in the text had at least an introduction and usually a short article by me. And the author of the Washington Post article admitted to me in one of our several conversations before she wrote the article that, no, she had not read anything that I had written, which I, again, thought was sort of remarkable. At any rate, why did the Greens come to our defense? Well, mainly, of course, because they had the knowledge to do so. But there's something much more important for us to learn from that. And it goes as follows. It sounds like I'm changing the subject, but I'm not. One of the 10 best articles I've ever read was published by a sociologist, a comparative sociologist by the name of Dan Shiro. Now, in my judgment, there's nothing quite so useful nor quite so rare as a good sociologist, but Dan Shiro definitely is one. His article is called "The Crisis of Leninism, the Decline of the Left, and the Revolutions of 1989. This is the introductory essay to a book by that title published by the University of Washington Press in 1991. This article, stands with Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society as one of the most important articles, one of the 10 most important articles that I've ever read. Essentially, what Professor Shiro argued was that the revolutions occurred in Eastern Europe for two reasons. Number one, the institutional arrangements, the socialist arrangements, didn't produce. They simply didn't produce their promised output of material product. But secondly, that they had totally lost their moral legitimacy. So when crises and cracks and strains appeared, the dam basically just burst and the systems collapsed almost instantaneously. Well, what I'm claiming is the same sort of thing is occurring in the environmental movement. For similar reasons, I find that the smart and honest environmentalists have basically lost faith in bureaucratic solutions to ecological problems. And it turns out further that the national green organizations, like Greenpeace, like the Wilderness Society, the Sierra Club, the organizations that reject market incentives, that trample on property rights, and that do not understand the importance of prosperity and responsible liberty, these groups are losing. They are losing memberships, they are losing budgets, they're basically losing. And in contrast, the environmental groups that understand the importance of responsible liberty, of prosperity, of property rights in the market process, they are gaining rather dramatically. These are potential allies. Now, I will be the first to admit with Fred Smith that there does exist a very large subset of watermelons, of people who are green on the outside, red and rotten on the inside. And we will never get them. They're opportunists. I said the sincere and smart and honest environmentalists will in fact come over and appreciate our positions. And that is my mission field, a big portion of my mission field, not my only one. I want to talk about communicating with people just for a moment. And let me just do an aside here. I hadn't planned to. We have, the Philadelphia Society has some really humorous people who are extremely adroit at making presentations and moderating at lunch and so forth. But I would say, just as an example, I did not find it offensive at all, but if we're reaching out to people, if we're trying to reach out to people, which I am, if we were reaching out to, if we were a Christian group and we were trying to reach out to Jewish people, or we were a white group and trying to reach out to black people, we almost surely would not make jokes about Jews and blacks. And yet we have jokes here about spotted owls and about Sequoia furniture and so forth. And it's sort of funny for us. But please understand that it almost surely will gratuitously alienate some people. And if we want to do that, that's fine. But let's at least be conscious that we're doing it. I try real hard not to do that, although it is tempting. I will admit that. Well, at any rate, an important rule, I think, of trying to reach out and bring the honest and sincere people in is to understand that people overwhelmingly listen to members of their own tribe. People tend to consort and converse and connive with those who share their own perspectives and values and approaches. Earth firsters, they hang out with their brethren. Wise use advocates hang out with theirs. Those who subscribe to the Unte Reader will probably also read Mother Jones and The Nation, not the Weekly Standard and the National Review. And conversely, of course. And when people from one tribe even consider the perspective of some other group, usually what they do is consider that perspective through the filters of one of their own tribe who critiques the other position. This fact that people consort with likes can create an immense amount of mischief, I think, misunderstanding, and lack of progress. Well, at Free, we understand this tendency. This is inherent to the way the world works, and we're unlikely to change it. However, we also believe that if we're going to really address environmental problems in a responsible way, we are going to have to recognize the importance of empathy required to communicate with sincere and usually woefully ignorant environmentalists with the analytic leverage of economics. And this is the origin of our newest program, which is the program supported by the Liberty Fund. So it's actually a Liberty Fund program that we conduct for the Liberty Fund. It's our Emerging Environmental Leaders series. And what we do there, it's modeled after our federal judges program, is we engage and challenge environmental orthodoxy in a very convivial setting. We have people like Lynn Scarlett and Jim Huffman and Randall O'Toole, and some of you will recognize all of the names, and all of you probably recognize some of those names. We have those people with us, not as lecturers, but as seminar participants, again, in a Liberty Fund sort of format. And we deal with people in their, basically, in their very late 20s or early, or I'm sorry, or 30s or early 40s. People who are not kids, who have been around long enough to understand that statist environmentalism really doesn't work, but given who they consort with, have never heard the alternative arguments, have never heard the moral cases. Bruce Yandel was just at this one. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to leave you out, Bruce. Bruce made some really important contributions in dealing with these young, emerging environmental leaders. Now, the guys my age are hopeless. They can't think outside the box. They have too much invested. Guess what? We agree. But there are people in their 30s and early 40s who really are, I think, amenable to our arguments. But let's not alienate them with gratuitous insults. They may be wrong-headed. They may be muddle-headed. They may believe silly things. But a lot of them are sincere. Most of them are sincere, the ones I deal with, and are relatively smart. Okay. I am absolutely convinced that I'm a very biased observer, but I am absolutely convinced that we, meaning many of the people here in this room, we have flat out captured the intellectual and the ethical high ground in the environmental and natural resource arena. Now, we could probably get a near Quaker sense of the meeting that that's true among microeconomists and professional policy analysts, but guess what? Economists are not really very good at communicating with others. My son is a PhD student in economics and public policy at the University of Chicago. As near as I can tell, everything he I can't read anything that he studies. I can read what he writes still, but I can't follow the arguments. He writes in Greek. They're all Greek symbols, as a matter of fact. They find calculus the most compelling form of communication. That's not a very good way to communicate. However, so even if we have captured the analytic high ground, we definitely are losing, or have not. I'm sorry, not that we're losing. We just not have yet won the broad public acceptance of ethically and scientifically and economically compelling arguments. And I'm not one who's about to give up. I have defined my mission field as being comprised of those individuals who are sincere environmentalists, not the watermelons. I won't get them. I don't care to. And I think it's important that we try to make these people, or to help these people, understand why a system based on incentives, on secure property rights, on the rule of law, is not only more ethical, not only more efficient, but indeed more effective in achieving their goals. That's, I think, exceedingly important. Well, the reality is that most Greens, in my judgment, are simply guileless. They are naive. The word was supposed to be guileless. The sincere Greens are seeking environmental quality, not socialism. But they've basically been taught, they've been brought up, they consort with people my age, except on their side, who are telling them that the market process is really just a means of big business basically raping the environment, and we are apologists for it. Now, after the piece came out in the Washington Times and our local paper ran it, I sent my response in, same one I sent to the Washington Post. The Bozeman paper did read it without checking with Ruth Marcus. And the response to that came from, it was typical, I was not at all surprised, one of the responses. The right-wing think tanks located in Bozeman, and there are three of us now, and financed by corporate wealth have the objective of privatizing public land and resources for their own profit. They attempt to weaken government and influence judges in order to accomplish their scheme. The ultra-right-wing think tanks have realized that the last reservoir of private wealth is on our public lands and resources, and so forth. Well, this was followed, I have 1 minute left, Danny, can I have two? This was followed by a response from a person, some of you might recognize him, he's noted from literature, really, his name is Don Snow, he's the editor of Northern Lights, has a couple books out, writes poetry. He's been to a number of Liberty Fund programs, by the way, introduced to the Liberty Fund through our work. He responded, the Chronicle recently reprinted an article first appearing in the Washington Post and so forth. The Chronicle carried this smear a step further with a headline, Judges on the Take. Given that the news media ranks next to elected politicians on the nation's list of the most despicable, perhaps the Chronicle should reconsider its choices. Then he goes on, after he recounts what had been said, unfortunately, the truth pertaining to the substance of the free seminar series went unreported. The truth went unreported. It's a shame Miss Marcus spent her time digging through receipts like a dumpster diver. She missed the chance to learn something about what's going on in the environmental policy world and to pass along some illuminating information on the complexities of resource debate in the West, and so forth. And then he concludes, more or less, the penultimate paragraph goes, Baudin is an environmental libertarian, a term that may seem oxymoric, but is not. The service he and his colleagues provide is to examine environmental issues through the lens of classical liberal thought and to allow others in attendance to challenge such thought. Well, I took that as a mark of some progress. This guy was a hardcore leftist, was a student of Saul Alinsky's, but by participating in programs, many by sponsored by the Liberty Fund, the fellow, being honest and sincere, is certainly an advocate of considering the validity and importance of our position. That's what I want to do more of. Thanks so much for giving the chance to talk with you about it.